Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here for the 1 o'clock hour. With me in the control room is Tom Hsu.
Hello and happy Thanksgiving to you, sir.
Wearing his best Pink Floyd t-shirt.
Ah, makes me feel good every day.
It's very holiday festive t-shirt to wear.
You know, when I think of the holidays, I think of people wearing Pink
Floyd
shirts.
Did you go shopping this weekend? Were you there at 8 o'clock at Kmart and Walmart and some other location?
I made a promise to my girlfriend I would not, because she had to work at a sporting goods store, and she was not excited about Black Friday.
Really?
Not at all.
But it's a new tradition now. We go shopping 8 o'clock. We step down a turkey dinner. We go shopping and buy things we all need.
Well, need is relative.
No, come on.
Oh, well, you're right. I did need that kayak. You're right.
Exactly. You know, the best part of Christmas used to be is the big wish books. Remember the wish book? You'd get a wish book. And Tom, you're a little bit younger than me. A little bit. But
just a smidge.
Just a smidge. But, you know, for a good number of time, I think from 1933 is when the first Sears wish book came out. And you'd go through the wish book and you'd circle all these things you wanted. You'd pass over the clothes, which you knew you were going to get. But then you'd circle all these fantastic toys. Let's play a commercial here. This is going to get us in the holiday mood here.
Fireplaces glowing, icicles growing, hearts overflowing with cheer. It's that wonderful season we all find so pleasing. The Toys R Us time of year. The world's biggest toy stores, Toys R Us. The biggest selection, Toys R Us.
Now, don't we all feel good now?
I feel particularly special. I remember all those, going to Toys R Us, and I'd get that big book every year, and I would go through and pick out, I want that, I want that, I want that. They pretty much made my Christmas list for me.
The Santa list was 5 pages long.
Now all I want, well, maybe I shouldn't say what I want.
Yeah, I might not get it for you if you don't. Let's play one more. This is one I particularly like. This is remember paper certificates before the plastic? You actually had a paper certificate. This is from McDonald's, 1978.
It was Christmas Eve in McDonald's land. Everyone was asleep except Ronald, who had other plans. Out of his bed, he silently crept.
Cuckoo! What are you doing, Ronald?
Shh! I'm giving McDonald's gift certificates to all my friends.
So Hamburglar can get a hamburger.
And Grimace.
Is it Christmas yet?
Not yet.
Grimace can get a shake.
Christmas.
Captain Crook, fillet a fish.
And the mayor.
Shh.
He can get a cheeseburger.
So to the chin.
I want to play audio of that because it's going to scare young children to actually watch that commercial.
I'm trying to think, is Grimace PC anymore? I feel like he might not exactly be politically correct.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you mean.
I had no idea either. Never mind.
But the wish book actually was discontinued in 1992. Sears published the last big wish book in 1992 amid layoffs and the closing of the catalog business. And what we have left today is some coupon books, some very thin booklets, but that moment of taking out that Sears catalog or that Ward's, Penny's, LaBelle's, remember that? And circling all those things. It's a bygone era and another flashback Twin Cities forgotten moment.
You know what I truly miss are those Lent calendars, because when I was a kid, I just knew when you opened those things up, you got chocolate behind every single day as you counted down. And I don't think they did that anymore after about 15 years ago. I think they didn't trust the chocolate that was going out all over the country in those little calendars.
I don't think so.
In a big, big nut shake.
We have Kevin Berger on. Let's introduce our guest today. We have Kevin Berger of BringMeTheNews.com, and you might remember Kevin from her days at KSDP-TV, WCCO-TV, KTCA-TV.
And you can still get chocolate advent calendars. Yes, you can.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen them in forever.
Mm-hmm. I have, as a parent, I know this. Yeah. As if you needed any, you know, I like the idea of using sugar to count down to a sugary holiday.
It makes you very excited, you know, for it.
Okay, Kevin, let's confession here. Did you go shopping on Thursday?
Did not.
Okay, well, good for you. Good for you.
No, I didn't.
Good for you. Let's, let's take a break and we'll get some more confessions from Kevin here. I think this is going to be a very, very hard-hitting interview. We'll be back with Kevin Berger after this commercial break here on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here with our guest, Kevin Berger of BringMeTheNews.com. Kevin, welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Thanks so much.
And Kevin, you and I were talking before the show, and I had your bio, I thought, pretty well done, but there's a whole bunch of things I didn't even know you had done. You'd done Channel 2, you've done NPR, you're now at Bring Me the News. And what's your title at Bring Me the News?
I guess producer.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're all producers, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a good one.
Yeah.
No, that's a good one. You came here from Ohio, and where were you from?
Actually, I grew up in a small town in southern Ohio. My dad was the high school basketball coach.
Okay.
And starting every small town high school basketball coach in America has a Saturday program at the local radio station, and they're all called Coach's Corner.
Okay.
And I used to, starting when I was a little girl, I would go with my dad when he would do the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit in these radio stations. There were a couple, because we moved a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, I thought that there was the president and then there was my dad.
Right.
You know,
course.
In
right.
terms of the importance and majesty in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That, and everyone recognized my father as this important figure. I grew up as my father was like a public figure.
How many were you in town? In your population.
6,000.
Okay.
You know,
so he,
and we were not a suburb. We were mm-hmm. 2 hours from a city, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he was this key figure. And so I would always go to the radio station. And, of course, people would call in and people mm-hmm. would – and the sports guy would interview him. And my dad was just this important guy. But I got immediately hooked as a you know, in the single digits, just the fascination with radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where it began. And then – when I was in high school at the small radio station in the town, after Coach's Corner, of course, we had the swap shop. Anything you want to buy, sell, trade, or give away, which every small town radio station in America
yes,
also has. And so the swap shop was after Coach's Corner, and they needed a girl to take the calls and write down the different you know,
items.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
the items, kind of a secretarial thing.
Card table badly damaged, but $1 or best offer. Right.
That's right. Yeah. And then so that when someone came in, you had their name down, just mm-hmm. sort of a record of it. And so I got that job. So I would go down with my dad. He would do Coach's Corner, and then I would stay for Swap Shop. And I did that all through high school. And so then I knew these people at the radio station from mm-hmm. having worked there. And then I wound up actually working there. I actually dropped out of college to work at that radio station.
What was your initial college aspiration?
Well, when I went off to college, my goal was not to be a school teacher.
Okay.
Because pretty much in the small town that I was from,
mm-hmm.
it's really considered part of Appalachia, where I'm from. Mm-hmm. It's down by the West Virginia border. And mm-hmm. not that we didn't really have college prep because people didn't really go to college.
Right.
And pretty much everyone who went to college wound up being a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were school teachers, and God loves school teachers.
But it was not for you.
But that was my goal, was not to be a school teacher. And so I went off to college, and I knew that I wanted to wear a nice suit and carry a briefcase and walk into important-looking buildings. But beyond that, I wasn't quite sure what it was.
So you grew up at a college, you stayed at radio, and at some point down mm-hmm. the road, you thought, maybe this is not a bad gig for a while.
Right. Well, when I I left college, started this small town radio station. My first newscast, I had two whoppers. I said that there was a bad storm where there was quite a bit of debris on the road.
Debris, sure. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And I mentioned that large city in Korea known as Seoul.
Oh, Seoul.
In my Seoul.
I've been
there was
to Seoul.
The debris of Seoul. Yes. And so despite that, though, that was my very first newscast. I hit two. I was on my way to a bingo.
Do we have that in card? I couldn't find that. I've been actually doing some research on you before the show here. But let's look for those tapes. So the CL and the Debris.
But still, I knew that this was the thing for me. I liked broadcasting right away.
So tell me a little bit about this journey from
southeastern Ohio. I always say I'm from the Ohio part of Ohio.
To Minneapolis, St. Paul.
So I left college and worked in radio for a while, went back to college,
mm-hmm.
and then wound up through an odd set of circumstances getting a job at a very young age without a college degree at the CBS affiliate in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
WBNS. And then after I worked there, I went to Detroit and was a producer at the CBS affiliate there. And then I wound up in Dallas-Fort Worth, where I was a reporter at KXAS.
Huge market.
Uh-huh. My news director in Columbus had gone to Texas
sure.
and brought some of us down. It was interesting. That was a It was a great gig. I really enjoyed living in a different part of the country. I was there about 3.5 years. My seatmate, we were in this very small little office, was a woman named Karen Parfit, mm-hmm. who went on to be Karen Hughes, who was mm-hmm. The advisor to George Bush. And our 10 o'clock producer until he got fired was Scott Pelley, who mm-hmm. anchors the CBS Evening News, you know. And if you would have come into that group and said, okay, pick the person who will be advising the president.
You, and you're going to be the national anchor.
Yeah, I would not, you know, who knew? But after a couple of years, I really was ready to leave Texas. And I sent out some tapes, and I got a call from KSTP. And I had never been to this part of the country. I had never been to the upper Midwest at all.
Luckily, one made it to Cedar Rapids, to Frank Magid's office.
And later I got there. But I don't think I had. And so I just got on a plane mm-hmm. and came up, met the folks at KSTP, and then wound up. I was just going to be passing through, you know.
Our guest today, Kevin Berger. And here's the question we ask every guest. This is a similar story. Is what month did you do your interview here? That is the quote, because you're from Ohio. That's not.
But I've been living in Texas, so
that's
yeah.
That's right. So what month did you fly up here?
I remember I was here for the first day of the Minnesota State Fair.
Okay.
So and it was one of those days where people were falling over because mm-hmm. it was so hot. And everybody, now keep in mind, I was living in Texas mm-hmm. and it was August in Texas. Mm-hmm. And everybody kept talking about how hot it was. I think it was like low 90s, high dew point. I'm not kidding. I thought they were kidding.
Humidity, did that make any kind of difference
at
all?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a hot, sticky day.
Sure, sure.
But it was hot and sticky in Texas that day and another 20 degree or, you know, 15 degrees
sure.
hotter. And that was back in the days when we wore pantyhose and polyester suits with big bows in that heat. Yes, sir.
You know, and just a quick little side note, I'm not trying to date you in any area here, but
well,
but
feel free to.
But women in journalism, it was still. I mean, a lot of women were regulated to doing, you know, being weather girls or being, you know, being eye candy on the news set. So this is kind of an era where women
feel free to call me eye candy.
Well, but you brought both.
I like you.
See, Kevin,
you know, I was never the first woman.
No.
I started really in the late 70s, and mm-hmm. I started at a ridiculously young age. My first job, I was just 21. So you can do the math
wow.
about how old I am. And when I came to KSTP, I was 26.
There's a generational cross, though. What I'm saying is there's this old guard of guys who maybe had gone from newspapers and worked in journalism, and then these fresh young
right.
women and even guys to come in and without that you know newspaper hard hitting
right.
typewriter background comes in and
right absolutely well all of a sudden stations were told that they needed to hire people who were not just white men
mm-hmm.
and a lot of stations looked around and said well who is there and they looked for women who had been on the runway, either
mm-hmm.
as pageant contestants or doing something with entertainment. And then they looked to content producers on the print side
mm-hmm.
because there wasn't a farm team
mm-hmm.
for women or, for the most part, for, you know, people of color. And so every now and then, you know, I sort of had that feeling like I through a weird set of coincidences, I got my first job. And I thought, okay, I've just been given a lottery ticket, and I have to be able to cash it now.
Right, right.
That I really don't deserve this job. I didn't earn it, but I can earn it now going forward. And I would say for the first 6 or 8 years, I put work ahead of everything.
Well, you bounced a couple different stations
mm-hmm.
and were promoted, and you came to KSTP in
1983.
And you stuck around a while. So something about KSTP in Minneapolis-St. Paul, something drew you to stay for a while. And what was that?
Well, you know, when I came here, I had been married for 1 year.
Okay.
And my then husband was a native Texan, but he was game to move up here.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw it as an adventure. We wanted to move to the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
either New York or Washington. I wanted to be a correspondent.
Capital correspondent, sure.
With a network, maybe go abroad. We weren't, you know, we didn't have it much beyond that. And I thought Minneapolis would be a good place to jump off from for that because a lot of people have gone to the network from the Twin Cities. But after a couple of years, we decided we wanted a family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing has brought me more joy than my family. Mm-hmm. And once you have, you know, those little kids, man, once you got them going on, the idea of working 80-hour weeks is, it just changes your perspective. And in the meantime, we both had careers that were thriving. We had a home that we loved, great friends. And so as a result, I never intended to put down roots here, but it's been a very satisfying place to live. Being from a Midwestern small town, the Twin Cities is a town full of small town people who came to a big city, and you know those values are really here. So I feel very comfortable here.
That's great. Well, we're comfortable having you here. Let's play some audio real quick. I have some audio. You went to Texas in 1984. You took a trip back to Dallas and for a convention down there, I think. Here, Tom, I have some audio here.
And moderate income people. Our reporter Kevin Berger now reports the Minnesotans joined with hundreds and literally taking their protests out to the streets of Dallas.
So good, send you back to Hollywood.
The voices of about 50 Minnesotans added to the rallying cry this morning, the Minnesota Acorn Group joining hundreds of other Acorn members at a campsite set up on the Trinity River. They're in Dallas to say they've suffered under Reagan administration policies, and they're here to try to do something about it.
We've got to do it. We don't have any choice. We've got to do it. The future of America depends on us. And you know, Ronald Reagan's future depends on us.
This morning, the hundreds of residents of this tent city boarded buses. Their mission, to go into low and moderate income neighborhoods and register voters. Voters sympathetic.
That's me, all right, isn't
it? There you go. A little warm in Texas that week?
Oh, yeah. But, I was used to it. You know, you can always put more clothes on in an extreme climate. You can only take so many off.
That's right. This is a video from the 1984 Republican convention. It's on tcmedianow.com if you want to watch the full hour at some point.
Wow.
You can see Stan and, well, let's see, I think,
that was a fun trip. That was a great trip.
It looks fun. I mean, anytime, you know, politics, no matter what your stripe is, it's fun when you're in the mix of it and there's people from across the whole country.
We had great years at KSTP. You know, they had airplanes. They had resources. They had travel. Incredibly talented producers, photojournalists that I would lay down and die for. I had just a ball.
And a family-owned company, and not to go political, but they weren't part of the union. So a lot of the things that you guys were able to do, you could do fast and quickly, and could spur the moment.
You know, it was like being a kid in a candy shop. I remember right after I got there, we were talking about going to southwestern Minnesota, and they said, well, like if you needed to go someplace to travel, did you want a helicopter? Do you need to land in a field because we've got a plane that could land in a field? Do you need to land on the water? We've got a float plane. You know, we had all this ability to get any place you wanted to go. If you could find a story, no matter where it was, especially in the, you know, that we used to call it the five state in those days, mm-hmm. you could go. It was fabulous.
It's interesting you say, though, it's like a kid in a candy shop, because I think you are not the first person to say that mm-hmm. of that era of news. But mm-hmm. And then it just all shifted. Mm-hmm. It changed completely.
You know, I've talked with – I have so many good friends from that era that we knew it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as like – we knew that this was something fabulous and to be grateful for. And a lot of the people that I worked with had worked in much smaller markets, mm-hmm. had worked their way up to get to here. And you know, after doing it the on the cheap and the hard way, mm-hmm. to have these kind of – resources mm-hmm. really was a fabulous thing. And then I feel like I was fortunate enough later when I went to WCCO, I was in a different golden era there mm-hmm. and got a chance to do a different kind of work there.
And before you went to CCO, you worked on Good Company also, correct?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Tell me how that you went from doing hard news to Good Company. How did that shift come about?
Well, I filled in a lot at Good Company, and I really got a kick out of it, and I got along well with the folks there. And then I actually just worked there for 1 year, not in the newsroom. But the biggest reason why I worked on Good Company was, for most of my years in the KSDP newsroom, I worked from 2 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
And they recorded Good Company at like 10 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I would come in. And I would do Good Company, and it requires a fair amount of energy to do a live. It was recorded as if live.
Well, you
and,
know.
And then I would.
Don't you watch that, Tom.
Go into the newsroom and go out on the murder, fire, political kerfuffle of the day, and then turn around and do it again the next day.
And you covered everything. You didn't have a beat. You had your beat right. was everything. Politics to murder to
general assignment, mm-hmm. they call it. Now, there were a couple of stories that I wound up spending quite a bit of time with. One of them was the Hormel strike. I was in on that for a couple of years. Oh my gosh, he just pulled up a picture of me.
Oh yeah, we're
with one of my fabulous perms.
Let's bring some audio up here, Tom.
A little bit tough as a reporter. Towards the end, the actual World Series itself, when there was so much national press there, to try and do a more battle intimate.
MTC bus climbing on top of it and rocking it. So I've got these bags strapped on me. The photographer's got the camera, and he says, I'm going to run down there and try and get a shot of that. So he starts running down
World
there.
Series.
I'm trying to run after him. So I'm running after him, and I lose him in the crowd. So in the middle of all this, we've lost one another, and I'm running around yelling, Ian, Ian, at the top of my voice, and people are going, Kevin, kiss me, we won. And I'm like,
well,
that's
fun being a news reporter.
That was a fun, those were fun nights.
You know, that Twins World Series, the first one, we have some video we've watched, we've talked about this extensively, because we live in the past here, we have no championships in this era.
Right.
But... As crazy as it was, there was not a lot of crime. There's not a lot of looting. There wasn't fights. I mean, there's some drunkenness going on. But there was...
It was good fun.
We kind of handled ourselves pretty well, considering we're not used to championships.
You know, I don't think that there's a group of people that view something like this as an opportunity to, you know, go to get something that they... have no right to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think we have the sort of the vultures circling going, oh, they're all having fun and celebrating, so let's go whatever.
Only during college hockey championships.
Yes. Good point.
Sorry. I think it's just a different era. I think that era here in Minnesota, we still have these values, just we have way more people here. But we all seem to be able to get along pretty well. We never experienced a championship, and everyone on this report here, this is actually the top story of 1987, and you're part of this. And the other story you talk about besides the Twins celebration was the flood of 1987.
Yeah.
You were out
the superstorm
working 2 to 11 that night, and
yes,
somehow you got talked and, hey, go out down to Highway 7 and
it was the old Highway 12,
Highway
12. As it was called then. Yeah, now it's 394.
Okay.
I was living in Golden Valley at the time, not that far from there. And I later found out that I had been put in a fair amount of personal danger being told by someone who was working on the live truck,
mm-hmm.
to go out and stand in that water while I was holding a live mic cable.
Electrical cables.
That I could have been fried. And this young man who was fairly new to his career,
mm-hmm.
said, you know, did you realize that you had put Kevin in danger? And he says, well, CCO's truck was right over there, and their rods were up higher than ours. And so I figure if lightning would have struck, it would have hit them first, not Kevin.
Look at the sensitivity for you. That. In fact, that was Debbie, our friend Debbie Ely, that was out there, right?
That's
We had her on the show, and she told us that she saw you down the river there.
And she said they were going to be safe. We were the crazy people.
I think we'll do an 87 flood reunion show sometime. We can just recreate this. No, and that was, I mean, I think of 87, I mean, the Twins World Series, the flooding, there were a couple other things that had gone on. I think there was a horrible adoption case that had kind of, you know, came to light. There's a lot of
things. What I remember about that, though, personally, mm-hmm. is that I gave birth in December of 86. And so 87 was a really big news year, but it was the first time that I had ever been a mother while I was trying to do some of these things and having to manage taking care of my child. Frankly, too much information. I was still nursing my baby. And I would go to work and, you know, and then come home and continue to do that for a while. And so one of the things that I've said is I wasn't always the first woman to do some of this stuff, but a lot of times I was the first woman who did it pregnant or who did it while trying to manage a family.
Well, I'm glad that they had the wherewithal not to send you out in the flood with your baby out there. That, I mean, that would have, I mean, now that would have been some good national press. I mean, look at
hey,
this.
Hey.
We have, actually, I think our second guest popped in. So let's take a break, cool. Tom, and then we'll come back on Flatfoot Twin Cities with our surprise guest. Flatfoot Twin Cities, Tom Osman with our guest Kevin Berger, and we have a surprise guest.
Julie Kramer.
I just blanked for a second. Your name tag, Julie
I'm
Kramer.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. That's my fault. It's just a moment where you have to be on live radio and you can't remember the name. Julie, I've seen your name in credits many times in video on tcmedianow.com, and we actually have some connections mutually, so welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Well, thanks so much. I just happened to be in downtown Stillwater here at Small Business Saturday, and I was at Valley Booksellers. They've got a number of area authors there who are signing and recommending books to shoppers, and it's kind of become a thing in the publishing world that on this particular day, authors go to small businesses and kind of for bookstores and
that's fantastic.
Chat people up. And
I saw
books.
That Julie was going to be here in Stillwater at the same time, literally the same time that I was here.
She was reading my Facebook page, media at work.
And so I said, hey, let's get together afterwards. And then all of a sudden I thought, well, she should come over here too, because Julie and I, after we've been talking about when I was at KSDP back in the day, and then I jumped over to WCCO in 92. And Julie had already been there for many years, but we wound up working closely. Julie she will never toot her own horn, but I will. She was considered the best investigative producer in the country. And the work that she did with the I-Team, she broke a lot of stories. She broke a lot of barriers. She went where no woman had gone, truly. I learned over the years so much about investigative techniques from Julie Kramer, and she is truly a legend. Now, what is people may also know is that Julie, all of that information about following sources and doing a paper chase and all that Woodward and Bernstein hugger mugger undercover camera stuff, she has now used that as the backdrop for a series of novels. And the most recent one comes out in January.
Delivering Death.
Delivering Death.
But yes, my books take you inside the desperate world of television news. And you see what it's like to work in a newsroom amid crime and chaos.
And gossip and backstabbing.
And Kevin and I saw a lot of chaos during
the time
we worked at WCCO.
Now, it just so happened that Julie and I both lived in White Bear Lake and were working in downtown Minneapolis. Julie still lives in that lovely community. I never do. I no longer do, but we drove to and from work together. So we started our day together driving in, talking about what we were going to do that day. Then we would go off and do our thing on these investigative stories we worked on. And then we would debrief each other on the long ride home. And so we truly spent, and Julie says that I used to do my...
I felt like I was, you know, listening to a radio show, listening to Kevin in the car.
and for an audience of one. And then I later went on...
And look, think of the 100% of the share you had with, you know, one person, 100%. She didn't have her headphones on. She was listening to you. So tell me about some of these investigative stories that you did, Julie. Tell me, you mentioned breaking barriers and breaking down. What's one that you think of that was either the scariest, toughest, the one you thought that if you want to define your I-Team, kind of career on that you're most proud of, what would that be?
You know, I mean, I'm proud of a lot of them. I remember one Kevin and I did that was a lot of fun, and that was about there wasn't enough milk in the milk cartons.
It's a concept called short weighing.
Yes. And we did that, and there was this memorable scene where we, and this was involving juice. There wasn't enough juice in the juices that were going to
schools. So when something says 4 ounces, it's... You're paying for 4 ounces, supposed to be 4 ounces, and it was like...
And we're interviewing the guy who owns the juice company about, you know, his juice, and we pour it into one of these measuring things, and it's very clear it's not, you know, where it should be, and then Kevin says...
Where's the rest of the juice?
And we waited and waited for the answer.
The awkward silence.
That was a good TV moment. We had some fun with that.
There was a guy we did a story on. They called him a curb stoner. Mm-hmm. That is a term in the car business. If you are selling cars, you're supposed to be licensed. Mm-hmm. And there are people who, as individuals, sell a number of cars. If you just kind of do it all under the radar, you're a curb stoner. You're not licensed. Right. So we got a look at a guy who was... And we found out they called him the spin doctor. He was rolling back the odometers. And so Julie knew how to find out what a car title, how many miles were on it when he bought it, and then when he sold it to someone else, how many miles were on
it. And how come in a week he was able to, you know, roll it back, you know, like, you know, 50,000 miles or something, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
But I remember we sent Kevin up to talk to him, and we didn't want him to realize it was Kevin. So, Kevin, how did you get close enough to talk to him to get the interview?
Julie and I went to the Harmar Mall and bought me a blonde wig.
Nice.
This is like a Barnaby Jones sketch.
I went up and I had all this stuff, and I had asked him to take a test drive. It was all being shot on hidden camera. And then I confronted him with, I just had, you know, two different titles. And then I pulled off the wig and identified myself, and
did you play dramatic music at the same time?
So.
No, we didn't. I remember it just happened to be my birthday for some reason, and I went out to dinner that night with my family.
Did the wig go with
as
you?
As a blonde.
I like it.
One thing, if you wear a wig for hours, you can't take it off and have your hair look good and be seen in public, so... Anyway, and that's one of the things I remember.
But
about
one of
that.
The things, Kevin has so much personality, so we did a lot of consumer investigative stories with her because, you know, they resonate with people because they deal with their everyday lives.
Right.
And so we had a lot of fun with her for those kinds of stories.
We found scanner errors.
Shopping like Scrooge.
Yes.
When
people who didn't... you didn't have to pay taxes on certain things and how retailers give that up. That shopping like Scrooge one, that one was really fun. We went back and forth trying to get different companies to match the price. And then Julie did some of this undercover stuff where you go to a major retailer, you know, a department store or others, and offer them a lower price to see if they'll take it. And
you know, quite often they would.
Uh-huh.
And then we had Kevin dress up like Scrooge for a stand-up for the piece. I called it Shopping Like Scrooge.
Actually, we hired a makeup artist, and I...
Does a photo exist of this?
We were on the set. Yeah, I think it does.
We need to find the photo of that.
We were on the set.
I have a basement full of old tapes.
At the Guthrie.
Okay, now his
tongue is hanging out.
So the I-Team, I posted the first I-Team investigation ever to tcmedia.com, the Al Austin Housing Inspector I-Team from 1980.
That's a classic, yes.
Posted a few weeks ago, got a lot of hits. In fact, the Housing Inspector emailed me and said, this is video we're all required to watch because because we... apparently, it kind of shook things up there a little bit. And one thing that I like, and it reminds me of the, you know, the old hour-long dramas you see on TV, is you build up and build up and build up to that final confrontation between either the hero and, well, the villain, but, you know, whoever the person that's doing wrong. When you did those confrontations and you're finally with the person in the room, you're pouring juice in, is that the complete adrenaline rush right there? When you're finally confronting a person who you know is doing wrong, you know they're going to lie, they're going to find some way of trying to talk their way out of it, but they can't.
Well, we're journalists, and so we have prepared our facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is less about that gotcha moment than also trying to have your story and having your facts so that you know what you're asking, you know.
And you want it to be balanced. This is their opportunity to explain that, you know, why what we are seeing here isn't correct. I mean, we want to give them a chance to explain what's happening. And much of the time, there really is not an adequate explanation. But you need to give them that moment. Now, sometimes they didn't want the moment. And sometimes they, you know, did try to ditch you. So you would have to, you know, chase them down the street to give them an opportunity to, you know, just your lawyer likes to be able to say, should it ever go to court, not only did they, you know, send all these messages asking for an interview, they even went out of their way to chase them down the street and ask them for an interview and bring the camera to them, and they still wouldn't comment. So, you know, that's how that goes.
For me, my background had been, it's like being a hunter. You go out, you see it, you shoot it, you eat it, you bring it back. You know, next day you do the same. Here's today's fire. Here's today's accident. Here's today's incident. Boom, boom, boom. And then when I went over to CCO, I had the chance to do these stories where we would work on them for weeks, months. I mean, we would shoot on these 20-minute tapes. And to do a daily news story, you'd shoot a tape or two. We would have 60 tapes. You know, and in terms of trying to really synthesize a ton of information, and Julie was so brilliant at this, the way she could organize that material and keep it all straight. And a lot of times she would be, you know, in the office working, and this was before a lot of stuff was online.
Right.
So running the paper
phone
chase,
calls
doing
and
this.
Papers
and then meanwhile, I'm running out in the field, shooting this, grabbing that. And then we'd sit down together many times on Thanksgiving, as I recall, Julie.
Well, because November is a ratings
that's
month.
Right.
That's right.
That's right. To then try and put this together and write these stories. We did just some great work. So much fun.
Our guests today, Kevin Berger and Julie Kramer, both of WCCO-TV, and Kevin, of course, bringmethenews.com. And Julie's new book is called, again?
Delivering Death, coming in January.
Fantastic. I want to play a little audio here, Tom. This is actually an iTeam expert. This is not one you guys did, but this is one that I, as a viewer, love because it is.
We noticed you on a number of occasions taking lunch hours from an hour and a half to 2 hours long, and also we saw you home an hour and a quarter before quitting time. What does that mean?
I just told you, if you want to see anything or talk about my job or me, see Mr. Dronin.
Don't you think you have an obligation to explain how you supervise the inspectors?
See Mr. Dronin.
How can Mr. Dronin answer for you? He doesn't know where you were on those days. He doesn't know whether you're going out in the field, does he?
There we have a classic confrontational interview, just like we were talking about. You know, you're following the subject down the street, trying to engage them. And this is not somebody who this is your first encounter with them. You've offered them opportunities to sit down for an interview, and they've declined. And, you know, this is sort of what happens with that. But it's also one of the things that just makes TV news so different from other media. Is, you know, you do have that experiential thing the viewer has about being able to follow along, and, you know, you're able to surprise them with something that maybe they did not see coming, and, you know, draw them into the story.
And I love that these stories were vetted and fact-checked for weeks and
weeks. Oh, my gosh,
yes. These are not just things that just kind of popped up last week and we went with it. I think that's, you know, you see TV news today getting in trouble so frequently, and national and local, where run these stories, run it quick, and then we kind of go backwards, fact check later, you know, looking for an internet search for a fact.
Quick, go which, check Twitter.
Yeah, check Twitter.
What's
and,
really rewarding is when you have a story that does bring about change, that gets something fixed that's flawed. I mean, that is, you know, what you're hoping for. You're hoping a story will have some impact. Do you remember the story that we did about the veterans without teeth?
Absolutely, yeah.
Fighting for a Smile. And this was about veterans who had gone to the VA medical center, and somehow their records had been lost. Their teeth had been pulled. They were supposed to get dentures, and the paperwork had been misplaced or misfiled, and suddenly they had no teeth and no dentures. And they
and
were
no
not,
way to get it.
Right.
And there were, like, you know, a couple of hundred people this had happened to, and we ended up doing a story about it. And
it was so sad. There was this one guy. He had been working for many years. He was wanting to go back to college. He wanted to learn that CAD drawing. I still remember.
He wanted to be an architect and had to learn computer stuff.
Right. Yeah, like to do that architect blueprint drawing sort of a thing. He had a plan, and he had to go back to college without teeth.
And he didn't participate in class because he didn't like to talk. He didn't want people to know he didn't have teeth.
It's so embarrassing.
And they kept being told again and again, I'm sorry, but we don't have any paperwork on you. You know, you got to buy your own teeth. And they didn't have the money for it. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, and some of these people were people, you know, who were heroes in Vietnam and in World War II. There was a guy outside of Mankato, and he would blenderize a hamburger because he was craving the taste of a hamburger and couldn't eat it otherwise.
I remember going there and he had like a hamburger milkshake, not a hamburger and a milkshake. Yeah.
But I know that we talked to, you know, some folks in Washington, and they were like, I don't really think that this could be happening. And I remember saying, okay, if we can prove to you it's happening, then how does it get fixed? Does it take 2 years of having hearings or something? Mm-hmm. And what they had said was, if you can convince me that this is truly happening, we will be out there the next week and we will fix it. And they absolutely did.
And
they,
it wasn't like we went to the VA and say, send us the list of the people who are... was very very painstaking process. Process to try to find these folks, a lot of shoe leather, a lot of hard work, a lot of just time consuming.
And again, this is an era before you had a digital device to be able to connect you know, back and forth. And you were in the car, you were in the phone book, you were
at the DMV in some cases asking for to buy titles and that stuff. And
I joke with some younger fellows I know. Just back in my college era, this is before the internet was really prevalent. And to get a book, to actually do a paper report, you actually had to go out and get books out. You actually had to pull books out and write stuff down.
It was the 90s. It doesn't.
It wasn't that long ago. No, if it did.
You would be out of touch, you know, when you're in the car. You don't have, you know, some of this was pre-cell phone, and you couldn't just reach somebody all the time.
Right.
And what I find interesting and makes it difficult because the novels I write, the murder mysteries I write, are set in real time now. Mm-hmm. So it becomes harder to isolate your protagonist because the reader will only buy in it a few times that, you know, your cell battery died. I mean, that's not an excuse anymore.
You have three extra batteries and a backup. Yeah.
You know, batteries last forever. You don't, you know, you're always charging them and that stuff. But back then you were a lot more isolated and you did not have, you know, all of these resources for gathering documents at your fingertips. You had to go from courthouses and, you know, search through files and, you know, various records and things like that. I know one of the stories that, you know, I'm real proud about is the Minnesota Board of Pardons, about how we examined, 13 years worth of pardons given out by the state of Minnesota and found that pardons were being given, not just people weren't being pardoned, they had set up a secret pardon system in which people who were pardoned, their files were erased. It wasn't added as an addendum. Their convictions were completely erased, and we found people who were convicted of child sex abuse who would apply and say, boy, I really want to work with kids, but nobody will hire me because I'm, you know, a convicted sex offender, and their pardons would be, their convictions would be erased, and then they would go on to reoffend. We found people who, boy, I got this arson conviction, but it's my dream to be a firefighter. And then they would erase the conviction, and some town would hire him as a firefighter, and pretty soon there were a lot of fires to put out.
I want to ask you about the question. This is not to be sour on the current state of TV news, but why aren't we doing these kinds of programs anymore? I mean, we've had people in this before who've been on TV news, and they're not in. We don't seem to be doing a lot of this kind
very
of...
Very expensive.
Extremely expensive.
I was going to ask that,
too. Very time-consuming.
Do you have time as a resource? I mean, back then, if you want to do the story, you could say, I'll have it done in a month. Or I'll have it done when it's done.
When Julie and I worked together, we would be working on five or six stories at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every story needs a deadline, and the deadline would always be in ratings months. Sometimes they took weeks, sometimes they took months. And
sometimes they took years.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just don't think that there is that kind of – it's a much leaner business now.
Just like we've seen since the recession, cuts in a whole lot of different areas, different kinds of professions. Journalism has really taken a hit. The media.
Well, what I believe is just about the time when investigative news stopped is when the websites of all television stations started. Mm-hmm. And so within a newsroom, say you had 100 people and maybe you had 20 assigned to long-term and investigative things. Now you've assigned those 20. You've moved them out of that and moved them to an ongoing 24-hour-a-day, 365 web presence where you're posting all your stuff and putting up all your stuff and maintaining all that. There wasn't any of that.
No.
And so that is also a labor-intensive thing. So a newsroom may still have the same number of bodies, but they're just creating a completely different kind of content.
Kevin, you're what we call a survivor. You've gone through multiple different formats in media, from radio, TV, online, different stations in town. And if you don't mind me saying, you're a breast cancer survivor. You've also survived that, which I think is just wonderful. We talked before the show started. You're in broadcasting and you're here to stay.
You know, I really maybe I'm too old of a dog to learn a new trick, although I certainly have had to update my skill set in terms of doing things in a digital era. And I do a lot of my own online audio editing now that I never used to do. Mm-hmm. They used to be somebody else did that. Yeah. You know, I used to, when I worked at KSTP, there was a photographer and they'd send him out to shoot stuff. And when it got complicated, he'd go, hey, he'd call in on the two-way. I need me a word man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you were a word man, or you were the kind of the technical side. You carried the mics and you carried the cameras. And now we all have to do it all. So it's changed. But I've tried other things. I like the deadlines. I like the pace. I like the irreverence. I like having it be my job to know what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. I like reading I still get the paper copy of the newspaper at my home every day. I do a lot of writing for the Star Tribune as well.
Okay.
I write for, I'm a regular contributor to the Variety section. So I still do that kind of writing and creating original content. That's just where I belong. That's just my thing.
When's your day off?
Yeah.
Well, that is the thing. The news cycle has changed dramatically, and maybe you've talked about that. Mm-hmm. But, like, for newspapers, they had, one deadline and one edition. And for television, you'd had maybe the noon and,
five, six, ten.
And then you
four deadlines
went
a day.
Yeah.
But now it's a 24/7 continuous. Mm-hmm.
But
news
I'm
cycle.
Just corny enough. Truth, justice, and the American way. Superman. A superhero. Mm-hmm. His job was to be a reporter.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And
Kevin up like super. Do you remember that
that's
one?
Right. That's right.
Superman?
I went into a phone booth, which they no longer have anymore.
What's a phone? Okay, I'm sorry.
We were doing a story on the cheapest phone service. And so I actually dressed up like Superman as part of my shtick to
super
tell
cheap.
That story.
There was a phone booth downtown Minneapolis, and it was in the Skyway by where I work. And I think that no one realized for months it had not even been working because we owned, right. Our company owned the phone booth. And someone said, does anyone know this phone booth had not worked? And she's like, we didn't even know it didn't work.
I mean, if you ever forget your cell phone, you realize how few pay phones there are out there. But I like one of the things that Julie's talking about, people who are getting a raw deal, people who aren't doing what they're supposed to it's not, is it the government's job to make them accountable? I mean, in a free society, that we don't work for the police.
No.
We don't work for the county attorney or the attorney general. A free press, I'm just corny enough, I'll stand up and put my hand over my heart and let the flag wave behind me. Truth, justice, and the American way. And a free press is central to that. I believe it. And it's part of the reason why I like to do what I do. It's not that I'm making the world safe for democracy, but I'm in that game.
Well, and I'm guessing Julie and Kevin, both of you, have been accused in the past of being too cozy with one, with one side of the story. If you're reporting a story and one side does not like the way it's told because maybe it's highlighting them.
Because they look bad?
Correct.
Well, there's probably a reason why they look bad. I can't make someone look bad.
Right,
they look
right.
bad on their own.
Right. But that's where we, there's the criticism of TV news. It's slanted. If you're taking the facts and you're presenting the facts as they are, and I think that the I-Team and Four Dimension News was known for, taking these, very lengthy,
complicated
stories and putting it out there, whether it be housing inspectors or judges, or you take your pick down the line, this is the story, and make your own decision. But there's always gonna be someone that's not gonna look great if they're not doing great things.
It was fabulous.
It was some of the glory days of television. But, times change. And television offers other things now, too. A chance for people to constantly be in touch with what's happening. You don't just have to wait until, you know, the newscast starts to see what's happening. Mm-hmm. You can see online now. And you know, I think nobody realized what a big impact that would have on the way news is covered. You're always on deadline.
Julie Kramer, your books are available at Barnes & Noble, correct? You're on Amazon?
My books are available everywhere. I'm, you know, just over at Valley Booksellers here in Stillwater, and I'll duck back in there here at the end.
Take a visit. Come on by. See Julie. And Kevin, thank you for being on our show today. Thank
so
you.
Much
it's,
fun.
It's been great. Let's do it again. I think we can do a two or three parter here, I think. This is Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Awesome. Thank you again, Julie Kramer and Kevin Berger. We'll be back next week here on KLBB Club 1220.